You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 621, where there is no imagination, there is no horror. Arthur Conan Doyle.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Today's show is sponsored by Jambox.io. Now, being in post-production for almost 30 years at this point, I've used many music services over the years. But I have to tell you that Jambox is easily the best music platform I have ever used. Not only is it super easy to find music, but the quality of the music is outstanding. Jambox works with some of the biggest music composers in Hollywood. They've worked with directors like Michael Bay and Martin Scorsese. And they have over 6,000 unique tracks and tens of thousands of stems and over 10,000 sound effects. I couldn't recommend a better music resource on the internet today. And the plans are super affordable, and you can ramp up or ramp down depending on the project you're working on. So I recommend you head over to jambox.io and use the coupon code HUSTLE20 to get 20% off. That's jambox.io. Today's show is also sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success.
The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Well, guys, today on the show, we have director Damon Thomas. And he is the director of the new Amazon horror comedy, My Best Friend's Exorcism. Now, Damon and I spoke all about the balance between making a good horror comedy, how you could do it properly, talking about Sam Raimi and Evil Dead, and a lot of the skill sets that are needed. And we really just talked about a lot of stuff that is not really talked about too often, about directors, about what it takes to make it, what his journey was in the business, and so much more. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Damon Thomas. I'd like to welcome to the show Damon Thomas. How are you doing, Damon?
Great. Great. A bit tired. We had the screening last night, the premiere. There was like 300 people at the Beyond Fest. So it was a big night. A lot of reactions, a lot of talking, but it was a great night. So, yeah, I'm really pleased to be here.
Great, my friend. Congratulations on your new film, My Best Friend's Exorcism, which is as insane as it sounds.
Right.
It's got one of those titles like Sharknado, like you know what you're gonna get.
I 100% agree with you. Like as soon as I got sent that in my inbox, like in 2019, and it was like My Best Friend's Exorcism, I thought this is brilliant. You know, you just can't wait to read it. And every moment since I got signed up to do it, where people say to me, hey, what are you up to? And I go, I'm doing My Best Friend's Exorcism. People always smile. Yep. It's just, then they go, wow, really? And you go, yeah. I say, well, you know what it's about.
Exactly. It's about My Best Friend's Exorcism. I mean, it's as perfect. I mean, it's like Jaws. Like, you know what you're going to get.
Wait, no, it's great, right? And then you say it's set in the 80s, and they go, great.
Done. You had me at hello.
It had me at low. That's the brilliant part about it too, is I was watching it. I'm just going, oh, the 80s. I mean, everyone's doing 80s stuff now, and Stranger Things has brought it back and made it cool again. But for my generation, and I'm assuming yours as well, the 80s, you know, is awesome.
Boom.
So my first
simpler times, right?
Oh my God, can you imagine? Oh God, simpler times when there was no internet, there was no social media. I mean, there was, you barely had remote controls on the television.
Right. I mean, when you think about it, you had to, if you were going to meet someone, you phoned them, and if you had a dial-up phone, you would slip on like the seventh digit, and you go, put the phone down, and go, but you start that whole thing again, and then you call your friend and say, like, I'll meet you there. Put the phone down. You go to that place, and if they weren't there, you were like, where are they? And then you'd have to find a phone box, call their house, and go, do you know where they are? And they go, well, they left 20 minutes. And you go, like,
no, it's like years lost. Years of our lives.
Also, you know, slight sort of off topic, but the feeling of boredom was something to behold back in the 80s, you know. But if you had nothing to do, there wasn't that instant kind of like dopamine hit of something new from your, like, oh, let's go down a rabbit hole down the internet now. And you would just used to stare and feel so bored. It was untrue. It was like a sort of sport. It was like profound boredom.
Oh, and you had three channels. And if nothing was on that you liked, you were pretty much done until you had a friend who had cable. And then you would go over and maybe get three more channels. And then you'd be, and if there was nothing there, you have to go outside and actually interact with other human beings. Scary. Yeah. It's terrifying.
Exactly. Or you had to like think of something to do, didn't you? You had to go
read a book.
Read a book. I mean, anyway, yeah.
It's just a bunch of, now we just sound like two old farts talking about the olden days.
I said it.
It's just two old farts talking about the olden days.
Exactly.
So my first question, sir, is how and why did you want to get into this insanity that is the film business?
Oh, you know, for me, it started when I watched Blade Runner in the cinema. I just went, I need to be in that. Somewhere I need to be in that. I mean, even back then, there was so little information about what that was.
Nothing.
Working in the film industry. There was like, we used to have this program that was just called Film, or whatever the year it was that Barry Norman used to present. It was called Film 1985 or 1982. And then you would just watch that. And that was the only information. Then occasionally you'd have an arts documentary. And that was, there's nothing else. And then you might look up films in encyclopedias. And now...
We're dating ourselves so badly. Encyclopedias!
But the funny thing is, my daughter, who's like 15, will say to me, it was really interesting in that movie. They like broke the fourth wall. And, you know, she's got her whole sort of like terms of reference about filmmaking and everything are so amazing that you kind of go, we were just in the darkness, in the wilderness. And so that I kind of got into documentaries, and then I kind of came, you know, it took me a long while to sort of find my route into drama and sort of directing drama. But then, of course, I just always wanted to make a movie.
Isn't it interesting, though, that, you know, I have kids as well, and they are, you know, much more educated than because there's just so much more information about everything.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, you would get the occasional Star Wars making of or the Indiana Jones making of, and that was pretty much it. I mean, you didn't see anything else until in the later 80s when, you know, then it started to become a little bit better. And then in the 90s with DVD commentaries and laser discs. Now I'm really going old commentaries of the Criterion laser discs and stuff like
that. You wanted to hear, didn't you? You wanted to hear like how he did stuff. It was like, you know, behind the curtain, the Wizard of Oz. It's like, how are they doing this stuff? How is it being made? How do you do this? And whereas now there are, you can just go on YouTube and go like, how do you do that? I'll just put it in, you know, and I'll find someone telling me how it's done, or someone would have made a film about it. And that is sort of great because it opens it up to everybody. Way,
but then the bad thing is it opens it up to everybody. So now, before you didn't have as much competition. Like I always tell people, like in the 80s, if you finished a film on 35, it was sold. Like you just. Good, bad. I mean, Toxic Avenger got theatrical release. Like, it doesn't really matter.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
But now everybody's making a movie and now it's about getting seen and all of that kind of stuff. But you were saying about your daughter knowing how the reference from references yeah. about that. The generation that's come, that is now, it is so educated in story. Yeah. It is so difficult for the for us as filmmakers, as storytellers, yes. to make something that's interesting that doesn't hasn't been done before. And every year that goes by, it's getting harder and harder yeah. and harder to yeah. because, you know, things that worked in the 70s and 80s just don't they can't work. And like I was showing I think it was some kids were watching Rocky the other day. Rocky.
Yeah.
And they're like, because they've just seen everybody rip off Rocky.
Yeah, of course.
For the last 40, 50 years. Yeah. So it doesn't have the same oomph to it as it used to. So how do you as a storyteller kind of deal with that? Because it is something very, very difficult. Things that Hitchcock yeah. never had to deal with.
No.
We do.
Right. I mean, I suppose every genre has tropes. And the horror genre is a very broad church, from slasher movies to psychological horror, to sci-fi horror, you know, to Aliens and those amazing movies, to kind of comedy horror. And so you know, the Exorcist is the sort of like the benchmark of like the handbook of how to, you know, are you going to do the vomit? Are you going to do and how are you going to do it? And it's sort of interesting because you're always going to disappoint someone. You're always going to, someone's going to go, well, I wasn't scary. But the thing about it is I didn't want the film to have this sort of tone that felt like an 80s movie. And then it kind of went into a completely new realm. Like, oh my, you know, where did that come from?
Right.
And I wanted it to stay within the same thing. So The Exorcism for me was a great, I thought, can we pull off this thing where it's kind of scary and quite disturbing? But then it's funny. It's like relieved by this real character of Christian Lemon. And the thing is, because he's sort of desperate. When I first met Chris, we were talking about it rehearsing. I said he's sort of a loser, but he's kind of a bit cocky.
A cocky loser.
Yeah, and he does want this. He does want it really badly. So that when the demon shows himself, he just goes like,
"Yes, we have it." Demon.
And does a high five, and she's totally traumatized. And for me, and it was great watching it last night because people really enjoyed that moment and really enjoyed Christian Lemon. And I think actually it showed me that there's kind of quite a nice group dynamic when I think you could really watch this movie with a group of friends.
Oh, yeah.
It's not like, I don't think it's a sort of, well, you know, people watch your mobile devices all the time. But it actually made me really think about that group experience of watching movies. You know, I went to the cinema, as I see Thor with my son, you know, a week ago. And, you know, it is great being in a cinema, isn't it? There's something that is, so that's why I thought last night, I thought it actually really helps when everyone's going through. Because like when she burns him, Andras, yeah, they all cheered last night. It was fantastic. You know, I was totally not expecting it.
But it's primal. Theatrical yeah. experiences, it's a primal experience and we're all around the fire.
Yeah.
It's a primal thing in group experiences of a story where, you know, the core of all stories is basically to teach us not to be eaten by the tiger down the street.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
around the corner. Right. That was the point of right. stories around the campfires. They were, and then they evolved into morals and lessons and things. And now it's entertainment because we get a lot yeah. of the meat and potatoes from other kind of media. But it is, yeah, you're absolutely right, without question. Now, go ahead.
Just to pick up on that point is I think that even if you have never made a movie, TV, and, you know, but people sort of absorb so much about, you sort of watch something, you go, they're going to get together, he's going to die, he won't, right. you know, you just feel it, right?
You know it.
You know it because you know how these things work. You sort of, so that when you get like, say a series like Severance or Station 11, you know, on TV, you literally go, I've got no idea where this is going. And they feel quite refreshing. And I wanted to do some things where you sort of felt, I thought, wouldn't it be funny if this felt like a movie that someone thought they hadn't seen from the 80s? So it had a bit of an 80s vibe. And, but also, if you had an exorcist that was just so unlike any exorcist you've seen before, and to really, but to make him, I really set him up so that when he comes to do the exorcism, you really enjoy him. So that with the high fives that he's always doing, up top, you know, that stuff. But you know, he is cheesy, but you know, there were weightlifting Christian evangelists. If you put it on YouTube, you can see these guys pumping iron for Jesus, and they existed. They were real. They were real people. So it's not far-fetched. And he is a real person. He is like, totally believes that, you know, his purity. And I mean, I even really like it that he can't remember Gretchen's name. Yeah, he comes out in the middle of it, goes, you know, what's her name? It's so true because it's all about him.
Obviously. Obviously, no. It's brilliant, and you're right. It's so because we've just seen it so much, and yeah. we've seen it done well, and we've seen it done bad. You know, so yeah, like, true. If you're gonna see a shark movie, and you've seen Jaws, yeah. it's gonna be tough for you to figure out a new way to do a shark movie because it was done pretty much flawlessly the first time.
Exactly.
And The Exorcist is the same thing. Yeah. It's flawless.
And also some people then get disappointed if you don't do the things that have been done before because you're like, well, what happened to that? Where's that bit? You know, and they go, but you're like you were saying, how do you do it different? You're trying to find ways to, you know, like reinvent the wheel. And it's already been filmed and done like 1,000 times. So you're in kind of familiar territory. But, you know, I did want to, yeah, as best as I best could, just get that tone right and, you know, if people, you can only do what you can do. You know, there's always,
Listen, we're in the world of everyone has an opinion, and everyone can express that opinion on Rotten Tomatoes or on, you know, comments and things like that on social media. But at the end of the day, as a filmmaker, you just got to do what you got to do. One thing I did love about the movie is that you are able to balance humor and horror, which is not easy. It is not easy to do that as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, because I've seen really bad, because if the balance is off, I've seen bad horror comedies where if the balance is off,
right.
You know, like Evil Dead 2 and Army of Darkness, like those movies, you know, what Sam in general, it can do no harm, no wrong in my eyes. But he's able to balance that, and you were able to balance the horror and the comedy beautifully in this film because it's not easy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes from truth. I think if your characters feel like the real article, even if they are heightened, I mean, we all know people that feel quite heightened types, don't you? You're going to meet people who are strong flavors, and they're real people. And Christian Lemon is a strong flavor, and but as long as he's being truthful to that character in that set of circumstances, and it's sort of balanced with, you know, Abby's kind of like sheer, like, oh my God, you know, it was one of the things I put in because he just sort of said, actually, he's an exorcism. And it, originally she went, well, how do I do that? I kind of said, she would really go, what? You know, it's not a normal thing, you know.
Generally speaking,
but because it's an exorcism movie, it doesn't mean that everyone knows that, you know, an exorcism is something that is actually real. So he talks in that really patronizing way when he gets the yoga pot. He goes, there's a demon inside it. Needs to, you know, he's really patronizing to her. And I thought that's exactly what he would say. Like, are you stupid?
And he's like, come on, of course it's just a demon.
Yeah. And so to your point is, that if you have, it's like in Killing Eve, I did a scene where Eve kills a guy with an axe, like being spurred on by Villanelle. But that scene is quite funny because the axe gets stuck in his back and so she can't pull it out. And so she's being shouted at by Villanelle, like hit him again. And she's like, I can't, the axe is stuck. And the guy's going, ah! And so it's kind of really disturbing, but it is funny because, and I think those things can sit right next to each other, like, because the Coen brothers do it all the time.
Oh.
They kind of...
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
You know, they put like, and I think that it's a bit like when you go to a funeral that there, you feel like sometimes doing the other thing that you're not meant to, like laughing, because it's the relief intention that you need because of the emotional expectation. You know,
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but when you said funeral, do you remember, I don't know if you saw this online somewhere, but some guy died. Okay, he died. And at his funeral, he put a speaker. He had his family put a speaker inside of the casket. And as they're this is part of his wishes, as it's being laid down, like, hey, no, I'm alive. No. Stop. And he's hitting and knocking and people are pissing themselves. I mean, the kids, everyone's crying, but then everyone starts laughing because they know it's what he would do. I'm like, oh my God, that is so brilliant.
That is brilliant. That is fantastic. That's forward planning, isn't it? That's real forward planning.
I think he was sick and he was going to die. He's like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this right. And my favorite tombstone ever is like, I told you I was ill.
That's brilliant. Very, very good.
Now, so when you started your career, Damon, I'm assuming that the second you said I'm going to be a director, that the trucks of money came in, all the doors came wide open. They said, Damon, whatever you want to do, all you have is time and money.
Oh my God, if only. Yeah. It's a long journey. I mean, I did a degree in physics and I, of course.
Because that's a prerequisite to be a filmmaker.
Yeah. And then I just got a job in, I got a job in BBC News, and then I gave that up to go and work on an arts program, and then I gradually just did more and more documentaries. Then did drama documentaries with about Beethoven and other things, and then I got just got a break. You know, someone actually approached me to do a drama documentary, and I said, "Why don't we just do a drama?" But it was set in the Antarctic. We had like £120,000 to make it set. And I filmed it inside a sort of ice fridge. It was all set on one of Scott's Antarctic missions. So that their breath was all sort of...
Because there's no budget for VFX. No budget for VFX.
Yeah. And we snowed up a studio that was tiny. And So it started back then in 2006. So yeah, it's been a long road. You know, there's a lot of miles on the...
Miles on the tires, as they say. Miles on the tires.
So
the question is, though, because a lot of filmmakers listening are going through these stages. And again, even in 2006, it was a different world than we are today. Like, you know, it's so much more difficult to get in now than it was in the early 2000s. How did you keep going? Is there any advice you can give to filmmakers listening? Right.
I mean, obviously back then it was a bit like if you wanted to make a record, you know, you just couldn't afford to go into a recording studio. So they seemed very out touch, beyond reach. I think the good thing about today is you can make a movie on your iPhone. And I think the thing, what you learn by just doing it is sort of, how do you make something that just kind of engages people, you know? And I think that that's the thing. You just start making stuff, even if it's, you know, you and a friend, do something about your life. Something that's kind of like, you could be filming your own house or in your garden or down the park or things that you kept. So they don't need huge production. So set something contemporary and just start sort of just putting something together. Because the thing is, that's what people judge you about. They kind of look at you and see, have you got a voice? Have you got a story? Can you do something funny? Can you make something? And you know, it's amazing how you can engage people with something very small. It's like, don't overreach. That's always the thing about filmmaking is, you know, don't just spend all your money on one shot and then the rest of the film feels like it's had no money.
But Kubrick and Scorsese did it. Why can't I?
But, you know, I was reading the other day because I love The Shining.
It's one of my favorites. Look, yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Me too, right? It's such an amazing film. And, you know, Jack Nicholson axed 60 doors to get his Johnny. That's over 3 days. I mean, I mean,
can you imagine taking one of the biggest movie stars in the world today, and you're not Stanley Kubrick, and going,
yeah,
or David Fincher at this point, and
yeah,
and just that's doing it. 60
door
takes.
Door number 40. Get door number 40, and they're exhausted, like axing doors.
I think Fincher on Social Network, when Andrew Garfield had to smash the laptop,
yeah,
and they did like 40 of them. He had literally 40 laptops sitting there because he knew it was good. Because that's David Fincher.
We don't all have that. I mean, you know, he's you could say he's right because he turns out brilliant film, right?
Hey, it's his process.
Social Network is that Shining is a masterpiece. And they change filmmaking, don't they? They change sort of that, you know, when I was doing Killing Eve, that I was quite influenced by, you know, Jack Torrance when he's sitting there and the whole dance is going on behind him.
I know.
And it's so like at the edge of the world, sort of madness. And so when I did Killing Eve, I suggested that we do this kind of like afternoon tea dance. So you go into this environment and Villeneuve was waiting there and there's this old-fashioned music playing, all these people just dancing, and it's like the edge of time. And I just, you get really influenced by, that's, you know. But sorry, we're sort of digressing. I mean, in terms of filmmaking, you just have to do, the more you do, the more you sort of learn, because you sort of realise, sound is quite important, get good sound, you know. And it gets forgotten, you know, sound, you know, to get great sound that you can actually use. You know, because a lot of times we have to do re-recording. A lot of dialogue is just like planes and all sort of fridges on in the background. And, you know, someone just decides to sort of, you go to the quietest place in the world. And on that day, there's a guy getting his tree cut down. And there's like, and you go over, you go like, people go over and go, do you not cut your tree down? He goes, no, it's I've paid for it. And, you know, you're like, going, oh my God. But, you know, it's all those, and you learn how, I mean, you know, working as I started as a trainee news editor, you start realizing, oh, you can cut that picture with that picture. They sort of cut together. Oh, yeah. How do you cut those? Oh, we actually need a cutaway on that, like a detail shot, because it helps me tell that story. And you realize that sort of objects, if you see objects in someone's room, you can actually tell exactly who they are very quickly. And so art direction and all the bits, you know, it's like a messy desk. It's interesting how some people do a messy desk, but it sort of looks like a sort of presentation. You know, because messy desks actually have smears on them and bits of crumbs. And, you know, it's all that kind of thing that you start to, you know, you become, you know, you just become super observant about things in a kind of really all the time, things that you sort of, that make all the difference. Now, you may be watching it as a kind of viewer and go like, it doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel like a real thing. But you can't put your finger on why it doesn't feel real. You know, it's a bit like door frames. In a real house, they tend to have quite a lot of scuffs lower down because of all the things that have gone through them over time. If they look pristine, it looks like a new build. You know, it's all those details that you start to get quite attuned to as a director when you start doing stuff. But, you know, story is king. You know, what's the story and is it engaging? It's sort of like you can dress things up with, you can spend millions on effects, but if they don't engage you about the human condition, then you end up going, I don't care. You know, you're going to see a film that costs $100 million, you thought, because we've seen everything, haven't we?
If Jurassic Park was just a bunch of dinosaurs walking around, and be like, it'd be a documentary. You needed a story. You needed to connect to those characters. You needed the magic that Spielberg brings in. Do you know, on a side note, since you're such a Kubrick fan, do you know, I'm sure you do know this, but I think it was for Eyes Wide Shut. He had his assistant run around.
Oh, all the theaters?
No, not the theaters. No, the side tables. Of couples in a bed, and he'd just go into people's houses just take hundreds of pictures of just how people kept the side tables at night. And he just used them as reference to build out his side tables for. And you, but who?
It's like, the detail thing, isn't it?
you just can't. But you know, you're talking about someone who spent 7 years prepping that movie, and it was great that he did, but it was horrible that he did because we didn't get more Stanley Kubrick films. I would die. I would love to see what Stanley would do with today's technology. Can you imagine?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Imagine.
I mean, you know, 2001 is just, again, it's so clever and so interesting. You know, that was sort of being made in the late 60s. And it's kind of amazing. You sort of, they are different times. And he was a particular, you know, very particular director. You know, I'm also a big fan of like Ridley Scott. You know, I think people are still trying to make Alien and Blade Runner. Yeah, they're still trying to make those are the benchmarks in a way that, you know, it's, you know, that sort of dirty future, like rain soaked, sort of the clash of kind of like different cultures from around the world, you know, that whole feeling. Of course they were slightly, you can feel it from the effects point of view, but the characters are so great and the stylization mixed together, that kind of, you know, the realization of it is, they had such an impact on me. It's why these, you know, you can still go back to those films. That's what I think about. How many films do you actually revisit and rewatch?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Apocalypse Now, you know, blew my mind when I watched it. I can still rewatch that film every single time because it's, you still see something new in it and you just think it's so incredible. And, you know, and The Conversation, you know, another amazing, amazing film. And, but also just great, you know, surveillance. You know, I really like the other movie, The Lives of Others, which is another surveillance movie, you know, another brilliant film. Because they're all about the human condition, but they just tell a great stories, really well told. And I think that's what you're always trying to do. I mean, you know, whether we succeed.
It's not easy, man. Listen, it's not easy telling a good story. I mean, if you're a good storyteller, and even the best storytellers that we have in the film industry, they don't get it every time. No. I mean, there's very few that have impeccable filmographies. Sometimes things happen.
And the thing is, you know, nobody sets out to make a big pile of crap. You know, no one sort of says, you know, this year I'm gonna make cats.
Let's go make cats.
40 million. Just, you know, just then move on, do something good.
I mean, it's everyone, just like
everyone, you know, it's a lot of people's lives, you know, dedicated to doing something. And that's why, of course, you know, I think it just takes a huge, I think the thing about it is just, it's that thing again of not overreaching. Does this feel right? Is this sitting right? You know, you have to constantly be your own worst critic going, oh, is this crap? What's this? Is this, you know, you have to, and also you have to be able to work with people that you trust their opinion so that when they go, that's why, you know, Robert Evans was such a great producer because he was able to tell, that's the trouble if you become, you know, a celebrated director. You know, can you take criticism? Can someone give you a note and go, is that any good? You know, and you go, you're right, actually, I think that's what, and that's what I think sometimes does happen. I mean, look, you know, if someone, you know, if you can make one shining in your life, you'd be happy, wouldn't you?
Oh my God. Can you imagine? I'd take almost any movie out of Stanley's filmography and go, I'll take that one.
I'll take
Eyes Wide Shut.
I mean, he would, wouldn't you? I mean, and that's why these guys are amazing. And you just keep kind of, you know, going back to the revisiting. Yeah, and that's why I kind of judge a film on, would I rewatch it?
Right.
Unless it's like really disturbing that I don't want to rewatch it because I find it too disturbing. But, you know, and it's funny how you can, if Jaws is on, you go, actually, I'll watch a bit of Jaws. You know, when you just see it on a streaming platform, you go, I'm going to watch that tonight.
Absolutely.
You just want to go back to it, won't you? And kind of you know, because also these actors that are in there, you know, Dreyfuss, they're so good, aren't they? The way that they inhabit those characters is,
is remarkable. Now, let me ask you, you know, as directors, there's always that day on set that we feel the entire world is coming down, crashing around us. Generally, yeah. That's every day generally. But there's always the
The heart in the vice. The vice slowly.
So there's that one day that's really bad. And, you know, the camera doesn't work, lost the location, the guy's cutting the tree next door. What was that day for you on My Best Friend's Exorcism, and how did you overcome it?
I'm trying to think of those days. Tell me if we had like a true shocker of a day on that.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
The thing about it is, I've been doing it so long, you literally, it's like this sort of thing that when it comes, you just go, yeah, whatever. You just let it, you sort of have to absorb it. And like I say, filmmaking is like the same, but always different because of the actors and the team that you have. There's always that combination and there's always something that will just go wrong. And you just have to, I think doing documentaries for years that allow me to sort of pivot in a way of just going, because I used to always turn up places like I'd never been before and like meet people, film them, and they're going to film some shots, and you were just making it up on literally, if you didn't get to recce, because so you couldn't sort of fly to America and meet the guy and go home again and go back and do it, you would just go and film them. And so it's kind of like taught me that don't get too rigid, apart from like action sequences when you have to really plan and storyboard them and then pick off shots, which takes a very, very long time. It's why like Bond has like the main unit and then it has the action unit, and they're running for like 6 months next to each other because of there's so many shots. But I think that sort of doing documentaries for so long, I just kind of, if things sort of go wrong, I can just go, well, let's try and do something else. It doesn't floor me. I kind of go, you know, and things just happen all the time, you know. And the classic one is you've got a driving sequence and you just go to the guy, right, just drive the car over there. And they go, oh, I don't drive. I had it
but, on your headshot, you say you ride horses, you play the guitar, and you drive. That's one of your special skills.
I always remember one guy sort of said, no, I spent the money on dance lessons. That's what he said to me. And I was a bit like, you know, I literally just said, can you just drive the car over here? It was like a really small oversight. And so we had to put him in the seat behind, in the back seat, and film in such a way and just mime the steering wheel when someone just drove in front of him. And we got away with it. You just choose the camera angle. And, you know, it's just, so you just like pivot. You just kind of go, like, you literally thought, of course, no one's asked him if he drives. But
basically directing is compromise in so many ways. It's constantly compromising and pivoting and shifting, because, and I don't know about you, I love to walk on set with and scare the hell out of my AD with like 150 shots on my shot list every day.
He likes goes, are you insane?
And they're like, we have 8 hours. And I'm like, they're there in case things go well. I know I'm going to shoot 20 of them, but.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that it is a sort of career of patience of just, I mean, when you think about it, as you all know, it's that most of the day is spent lighting.
Mm-hmm.
Lighting is, or it's, you know, and lighting is key. It makes everything look great. And you just, so, you know, you block side of your shots, you sit, and then you start lighting. I mean, you know, you just spend a lot of time lighting. So it's like riding that wave of, oh, you know, waiting for lighting. But, you know, that's not me denigrating the director of photography. It's just like, that is the life, isn't it? It's the life of just kind of finding that inner.
That inner zen of place. You're like, okay, we're ready. Oh, okay, 3 hours. How many? 2 hours? 2 hours? It's because they'll tell you 90 minutes, but it's going to be 2 hours.
I mean, and the other interesting thing, I think, is that people who don't work in the industry often say, you know, when you work with actors, they go, but you're the director. They just do what you say. You kind of go, it doesn't quite work that way. It doesn't, you know, that's not how it works. And they just don't understand that. It's a very, you know, because actors do something that's really unique and special. And it's such a, exposing an amazing thing. But it's not just about you do that over there. It's not that. It's a kind of proper creative relationship that you sort of embark on.
Isn't it interesting though, when normies, I call them normies, people outside of the carnival business that is our world, come on set and they've only seen like behind the scenes and everything's edited. So it, like on set seems like pop, 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 pop.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
It's you're going fast and they're sitting there like 3 hours later, they're sitting in the chair with the headphones on for sound. And they're like, this is boring. It's crap. And I'm like, it is. On a Marvel movie, they'll spend 8 hours lighting for one shot.
Yeah.
Because they have all the money in the world.
Tim Burton will just shoot two shots in a day and he'll just spend the whole morning just rehearsing a big shot that has a lot of moving parts. And that's what you do. You have to, if you're going to shoot a shot, you're going to shoot it well, or don't shoot it. This is the crazy thing sometimes about shooting is don't shoot. That's another thing I'd always say, don't shoot. I'll say crap, but don't shoot rubbish, shoot stuff. Because you're always going to look at it later and go, oh, why didn't I just, and the thing about it is that's what you have to do as a director. You have to go, it's not right. We need to, it doesn't feel right. And sometimes you set for a shot and you have to have the confidence. And it might have taken quite a long time to put the camera down there and the rigging and the guys, the grips. And then you start looking at it and go, it's not right. We just actually need to be over here. And you have to have the confidence to go, strip it all out and have people around you that kind of go, yes, you're making it. Yeah, we see it. And also don't get sort of then also admit that you're doing something wrong sometimes, like this actually,
I was wrong. But that takes time to build up, because when you're first on set, you just don't want to look like you don't know what you're doing.
Of course.
But as you get older and you've got more shrapnel in you, you just go, guys, I made a mistake. Let's go over here. This is just not working.
It's
gonna take 2 hours. I'm sorry. Let's go.
Yeah, and you'll never regret it, because you're just the footage that you get will be like, you think, thank God, because you might as well shoot something great that took twice as long. I mean, it depends about obviously jeopardizing a location, whatever. You have to. That's why it's a sort of system of moving parts. You're always going, oh my god, can we, we're only in here for one day. Like the interior of the weird little house, where it happens, was actually the upstairs corridor in this other building. If you saw it from the outside, you'd never believe that we were, that was the inside of the house. But we got real freedom to like smash it up inside, but we had such limited time in there,
Isn't it true though that you have to sit once in the edit room and go, why didn't I move the camera? Why did I accept that shot when I knew something inside of me was telling me, no, you've got to, but you didn't have the balls or the confidence to change. And you're in the edit and you're edit and you're in the edit room and you're like, God, I need, we either, oh God, I got to get saved somehow with this.
Yeah.
These are lessons you learn along the way. And then eventually you just like, I know. I'll get the shots that I need. I got to shoot the ashtray. Why? Because I need a freaking cutaway. To save my ass, just in case.
Yeah, and it's just, And also you have to rely on people around you. You just have to rely a lot. You sort of, over the years, you sort of see the problems coming, I think. That's what happens. That's what I sort of see. You sort of go, I know that we do this, that's not going to work probably, because you've sort of been there like 10 times before.
Sure.
Thank you. And that's why experience, I think, counts for a lot,
Without question.
If you move and do different kind of genres occasionally, you sort of come over here, you sort of think, well, I've done a shot like that. I did a shot where someone underwater, I did that crash, I did someone leaning over, and I just did it by putting a green screen. And it's also knowing sometimes people can't, I just did a thing about the Black Panthers in the early 70s, and we just needed somewhere that was on Mulholland. And I just saw a sort of shape in a park with a pathway. I thought that'd be great, actually, because you put the car here, just put a green screen around it. Everyone's sort of going, like, are you mad? You know, I think, but we did it because I just knew it would work, the shape, and I could, it felt like a sort of lookout point that you could put a car on and it had a, you know, and you just, it's like we did a sort of, we had to recreate the Mexican border, and we literally did it in like an IKEA car park. And so you go on the tech recce, you go, and it's just as concrete. And it was literally going, I don't get it. I just don't see it. And you have to say, well, look, we put all the crossings here, put the fence there, put all the trucks here. We put like a blocking load of big trucks on that size. And then it just sort of, it sort of, you have to visualize it. I think that becomes a thing as well, that you start to visualize things within spaces. And I think that is another thing you start to see. Because right. You start thinking, I do think, and it's not all, it depends what you're like as a director, I don't know about you, but I like photography. So I like, So you sort of like, I like photography, you know, you get quite into composition and it's a bit like taking photos of people just, you know, when you think about it, like, you always take a photo sort of at shoulder height like this. It's rare that you sort of get on the floor and go like, oh, let's do that. You know, you're out, you're not going to lay on the floor, are you? You're never going to put the camera down there. But you have to start thinking about that when you start shooting as a director. You sort of think, well, where can the camera go? How does it make me feel about what I'm looking at, putting the camera in different positions? And that's another thing, you start freeing yourself up about not just going, here we are.
Right.
But sometimes the simplest things are just as effective. That's the other thing.
They get just
hung up on just making things really flashy, because in the end, it's the performance and the writing that are going to sell it all.
I mean, you could look at some John Ford shots, and you're just like, "Well, that's a masterpiece," and they just have to, and he just locked the camera off.
Yeah,
and it's
the radio. You know,
just lock it off.
Just look at just you know,
it's insane.
Yeah, but you know, that's a lot to do with location, isn't it? And get just sort of going, we've got to go all the way to this remote place and do that shot.
IKEA, and a green screen. You got Lawrence of Arabia. What are you talking about, David? Exactly. That's all you need nowadays. If he would have had IKEA and some green screen, we wouldn't even the desert. That's crazy.
That's right. He'd have been down at Santa Monica Beach.
So my last question to you, sir, is, if you were able to go back in time and talk to your younger self, is there one piece of advice you would give them, give him? One piece of advice about your filmmaking journey? Like, dude, you know, you really need to look out for this.
I think is to do as much of it as you can. Sort of don't kind of just be waiting for the one moment that you feel is coming at a certain point in time. Just start shooting things. Just make a small film, even if it's like a drama set in your own house with your family. You know, if you're just think of a story, and also if it comes from you, your own experience, then it will be truer, won't it? So that if something has happened to you, and you could do it, and you'll be surprised at who can act sometimes as well. You know, and then by shooting something and keep it very small, just do something very limited. And just see if you can make a narrative last for like 2 minutes or 3 minutes and put some music on it. Then I think obviously back then there was a sort of, we didn't have either the technology. Whereas now, you could just do it. And I think that in a way we have too many tools, you know.
And not enough story.
It's true though, isn't it? And so kind of what's the everything, everywhere, all at once, that movie?
Daniels. Oh, they're great.
Oh, what an amazing kind of, but also very, very interesting about the human condition, isn't it? It's all about what people mean to each other and what, and it's, I mean, people with Frankfurter fingers. I mean, it's.
When I had them on the show, I'm like, dude, hot dog fingers, guys, seriously? And they're like, yeah, we were high. So
is that what they said?
I think they said something along those lines. Because this is insane, guys. This is insane.
That's what I love about that film. Is like, it's like we learn to express ourselves with our feet. And I think Jamie Lee Curtis is there. And then this little foot just covers up her face and starts. I just thought, And the thing is, it's nuts, but it's true to them. It's very true.
Perfect. You know? It's perfect.
And I thought, that's just really clever and just funny, very funny and touching. And they're great, those guys. God, they are great.
Damon, I could keep talking to you for about another 5-6 hours about geeking out over a film. I mean, we could just start talking about Kubrick for an hour alone. Where can people see your new film, My Best Friend's Exorcism?
It's on Amazon Prime Video now. It's released today, the 1st of September. And
perfect Halloween film. Perfect Halloween film.
Yeah. Well, watch it with friends.
Yes. Yeah,
like my first AD, Steve Moore, fantastic guy. He's doing a party tonight. They're reenacting one of the Lemon Brothers scenes tonight.
Nice.
With his friends. Fantastic. Yeah, watch it with the group.
My friend, congratulations on the film, man, and continued success with I can't wait to see your next films coming up, my friend. So I appreciate you, my friend. Thank you again.
Thank you. Thank Alex. It's been brilliant. Thank you.
I want to thank Damon for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Damon. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to watch his new film, My Best Friend's Exorcism, on Amazon, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/621. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there. And I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's INDIEFILMHUSTLE.com.